Athens, 350 BC.
For the angry man is aiming at what he can attain, and the belief that you will attain your aim is pleasant. Hence it has been well said about wrath, "Sweeter it is by far than the honeycomb dripping with sweetness, and spreads through the hearts of men."
Excuse me, Aristotle? You're walking kind of fast. You know I have trouble keeping up with you when you walk like that.
Really? I did not notice I was walking fast. Anyway, spite is also attended by a certain pleasure, because the thoughts dwell upon the act of vengeance, and the images then called up cause pleasure, like the images called up in dreams.
Ow! See, not only were you walking fast, but you kind of steered me into that pricker bush. Aristotle, are you mad at me about something?
Not that I'm aware of, Wolfetes.
Was it last week when they had the free stuffed grape leaf samples in the marketplace and I took the last one?
No, you didn't take the last one. You ate two, and then there weren't any more.
Two is okay.
It's so not okay. This is covered by Plato, by Socrates. Everybody gets one when there's free samples.
Oh, so now you're motivated by spite.
Spite is good. You know what we'd have if there were no spite? Nothing. We'd just sit around like that idiot over there, the one who took the last chariot space on Monday.
Oh, the one you accidentally spilled your hot lentils onto and then you had nothing to eat?
It was worth it. Stupid bust-out jerk.
Wow, you are one angry philosopher. Today on the show, we'll ask whether we've made any progress or whether we still need spite. And now, his life is ruled by his hidden grudge against Laura Linney, Colin McEnroe.
Yeah, the problem is what she did. You know, I can't even talk about it. I'm just still so angry. I didn't even send her like a baby present or something. She had a baby anyway. We want to thank the lyre player who came in, by the way. Booking a lyre player for one of those sessions, very, very expensive. And I also have to say that in writing that intro, I did steal a little bit from Larry David, perhaps the king of spite in certain ways. He's, of course, the person who has very strong feelings about how many free samples you can eat if there are free samples available. All right, we're going to talk about spite today. We got very interested in this because of an article that we read, and we all thought, well, this sounds like the kind of show that we would do. But then there's the sort of the question of what is spite? How is it different? And what do you think people think about spite? So we sent our very spiteful intern, Skylar Magnoli, out into the streets to ask them about spite.
What is the worst thing you've ever done out of spite?
I usually wouldn't want it done to me, so I don't do it.
Honestly, no, I'm not a spiteful person.
Probably talked about somebody because they probably did something to irritate me.
Put salt in my sister's cereal instead of sugar. She locked me out of the house and it began to rain.
That's a good one. We really hated this one teacher. And so then we messed up all the books on our bookshelf. So we were like taking them out of order because that's like her biggest pet peeve. So we were just trying to make her mad for like a whole week. And we were doing everything that she hated. And it was actually a lot worse than you think.
Probably yelled at people who were texting while they were driving.
All right, so not all of those necessarily conform to any kind of academic or rigorous definition of spite, to the extent that there can even be one of those. So today we're going to look at spite across a series of different models and disciplines. We're going to start with David Marcus, professor of psychology at Washington State University, who has looked at psychological models and psychological sort of testing models for studying spite and developing a spitefulness scale. First of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So let's begin with at least a definition for your purposes of spite. Spite overlaps with so many other things, with hatred and anger and vengefulness and schadenfreude and a whole bunch of other qualities. So how do you sort of find the little shaded area in the Venn diagram of those things that is spite?
I think because some people do use spite like synonymously with vindictive or hostile or aggressive, I think what makes spite unique is spiteful actions also involve a cost to the person who does them. It's not enough that you're hurting someone else, putting salt in someone's cereal instead of sugar. It's doing it and also potentially opening yourself up to being hurt back or in the act costing yourself something. So, yeah, if you knew you were going to get locked out of the house afterwards and left in the rain, that would be a spiteful action then.
So in our introduction, for example, when Aristotle confesses that he deliberately spilled hot lentils onto someone that he was mad at and then had nothing to eat, that would be an act of spite.
Absolutely.
In attempting to study this, first of all, one of the first things you did, I guess, was to try to develop this spitefulness scale so you can measure it. Explain how you did that.
Colleagues and I just sat down and tried to think of as many examples that seemed realistic and that actually seemed to occur in people's lives in which people would engage in spiteful actions. So the initial step of any kind of scale development is just trying to generate items. And we did it in the form of very short vignettes. And again, most of them we aim for things that are pretty much everyday experiences, pulling out of a parking lot and seeing someone waiting for the spot. There's already been some research that sometimes people slow down when they see that.
Right.
That would seem like a spiteful action. Waiting, checking out at the grocery store, feeling like the person behind you is impatient, so taking your time paying. It's not a big cost to you, but you could have been out of the grocery store quicker. Things like that.
So once you had the scale and once you began to measure people with the scale, what did you find?
First thing we did was we wanted to figure out which of the items on the scale really seemed to work. And so we started out with 31 items, and we got 17 that seemed to have very good discriminatory properties, that they tend to cluster together and all seem to be tapping into this notion of spitefulness. Then the next thing we did is we looked at how that related to all those other kind of personality traits and characteristics that you mentioned at the beginning that should be overlap with spite but shouldn't be the exact same thing. So like aggressiveness, Machiavellianism, narcissism, those kinds of other negative personality or dark personality traits. And we found that it generally did associate with those.
Which isn't that surprising. In other words, we'd have to assume that if you are that kind of person, if you're narcissistic, if you're Machiavellian, probably you're going to include spite somewhere in your behaviors. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So, if we didn't find that, it would have suggested that our measure wasn't probably measuring what we thought it was. The other thing is we did see some group differences in it. We found that older people are less spiteful than younger people in our sample. It seems perhaps, assuming the measure actually is measuring what it claims to measure, that as people get older, maybe they mellow out a little bit and become less spiteful about stuff.
Or we're just too tired to act spitefully. It's just too much.
That's possible, too, yeah. And it's also possible, again, we also made up a number of items because a big part of our sample was college students that are kind of student-like experiences, like, hope. Foregoing extra credit if your classmates that you don't like won't get it, or taking extra time on a test just to make the professor sit there and wait longer. That one came from personal experience. So maybe some of them were less relevant to older folks, but I think it does kind of fit with, I think, people's experience that, as you get older, either it's less energy to act spitefully, or maybe there is a tendency to be able to take perspective of others a little better and feel less spiteful. That's kind of an optimistic take. I don't know. We also found that men were more spiteful than women on the scale.
It's interesting. Well, as we go along here, by the way, if you have a question or a comment or something you want to tell us about, or perhaps tell David about the role that spite plays in social psychology and daily interactions, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. I don't know how much of this has been measured, but one of my other questions is how okay people feel about their own spite. In other words, to what degree is—and I even wonder that about the age disparity, whether a younger person wouldn't understand that there are social sanctions that might be brought against you if you exhibited and were pretty comfortable with your own spitefulness. Maybe as we get older, we learn to be a little bit more discreet about it. But I also just wonder in general, do people regard spitefulness as something they should be ashamed of?
That's a great question. And to be honest, we didn't look at that yet, but it's a really interesting question. I mean, we did find that people who are more shame-prone are more spiteful, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tend to go around feeling a lot of shame, you tend to act more spitefully, as opposed to if you're guilt-prone, you're less spiteful.
And you know, one of the things that intrigues me about this, too, is if there are things that people feel ashamed enough about to repress or either repress the behavior itself or at least not talk publicly about the behavior, it would – I mean, you know, we have this whole phenomenon – not that I watch much of it. We have this whole phenomenon of reality TV where I'm given to understand one of the things that happens is that people on a lot of these reality TV shows really are very open about their spite. First of all, they're often in a game situation where they need certain motivations to fuel certain behaviors and to create certain kinds of alliances against one another. And they're pretty open talking to the camera. I'm sure they're prompted heavily by producers and things like that. But in talking about how much they hate this or that person and how prepared they are to act in a negative way towards that person and to create certain scenarios. And I'm wondering if maybe that's sort of a form of pornography where people talk about spite in a way that they don't feel comfortable in their own lives.
Yeah, I'll admit I don't watch a lot of reality TV either, but it does seem like it certainly pulls for bad behavior on people's part. It seems a lot of that may be, again, to kind of make a trivial distinction is it seems it's very vindictive and aggressive behavior. Mostly, though, it seems pretty instrumental that they are being encouraged by producers. They're getting rewarded for doing those behaviors. So in that sense, I don't know if it's spiteful because they're actually not incurring a harm. They're getting to be on the show for even longer and getting more camera time, which apparently would be rewarding for them.
But I'm also wondering if we, the watchers, are looking at that and going, oh, see, she gets to be spiteful and nothing bad happens to her. I wish that I could do that. Because I want to come back to your model. I mean, one of the questions one has is, okay, so let's take something really simple. There's somebody waiting for your parking space, so you pull out extra slowly, just out of spite. Now, you don't have any reason to hate the person who's there. You don't even know who that person is. But just for some reason, you know, and you are acting to your own disadvantage. First of all, it's going to take you longer to get out of the parking lot if you engage in this behavior. And, of course, there's also the possibility something considerably worse might happen because people have road rage and parking lot rage and stuff like that. So when you look at that behavior, I assume one of the questions you're asking is it just sort of completely maladaptive behavior that has no purpose whatsoever and, in fact, is really kind of disadvantageous? Or is there some reason, some rational reason, some way it makes sense?
I think there's probably within spitefulness both those kinds of instrumental spiteful behaviors, times when being spiteful will ultimately get you something, versus just purely hostile and impulsive spiteful behaviors where there may not be a benefit to that. That's kind of the most interesting, when people are willing to me at least, when people are willing to hurt themselves, and there really doesn't seem to be any end game, any long-term benefit to doing that, as opposed to a more kind of strategic spitefulness where the person is being spiteful because in the long run they'll benefit. A lot of the spitefulness research that's taken place has been done by economists who've looked at, like, the ultimatum game, where one person gets to divide an amount of money and the other person then their only decision is whether both get to keep the money or they both lose out. So, you know, someone divides $10 and says, I'm going to keep $9, you get $1. The other player may just spitefully say, no, neither of us are keeping any of this. If you're playing consistently against the same person, it makes sense to be spiteful. It's strategic, right? If someone offers you $1 and you say no, and then on the next turn they're probably going to up their offer.
Mm-hmm.
But other people have done studies where they use an ultimatum game where you're consistently playing against a different person or you believe you're playing against a different person. There's no benefit at all to rejecting the offer, right? Someone offers you you're either a dollar richer or you get nothing. It's not going to affect future play. And yet people still spitefully will reject an unfair offer. It doesn't seem like there's any, at least in that situation, gain to do it, but yet certainly people are not inclined to let someone walk away with $9 and they get $1, even though it won't affect what happens in the future. So there it doesn't seem strategic. It seems purely just, this is wrong, I'm not going to put up with this, too bad we both lose.
But at a more sociological level, at the level of sort of what's normative, it seems to me that one of our assumptions that's built into the culture is that spite's a bad idea, that if you do things out of spite, it will cloud your judgment. Now, one of my Rosetta Stones for understanding all of America American Life are the Godfather movies. So so in the Godfather movies, we are sometimes told, or the characters are one of the lessons that exists within the Corleone family is don't let spite cloud your judgment, although there seems to be an awful lot of spite within that world. But let's play a little clip here. Let's play the long clip from the Godfather.
You're going to search me when I first meet them, right? So I can't have a weapon on me then. But if Clemenza can figure a way to have a weapon planted there for me, then I'll kill them both.
Hey, what are you going to do? Nice college boy, huh? Didn't want to get mixed up in the family business? Now you want to gun down a police captain? Why, because he slapped you in the face a little bit? Huh? What do you think, this is the army where you shoot him a mile away? You got to get up close like this, and bada-bing, you blow their brains all over your nice Ivy League suit. Come here. Mwah! You're taking this very personal. Tom, this is business, and this man is taking it very, very personal.
Where does it say that you can't kill a cop?
Come on, Mikey.
Tom, wait a minute. I'm talking about a cop that's mixed up in drugs. I'm talking about a dishonest cop. A crooked cop who got mixed up in the rackets and got what was coming to him. That's a terrific story. It's not personal, Sonny. It's strictly business.
So, David Marcus, you know, the norm that's contained in that particular conversation, you know, Michael has had a bad run-in with this corrupt police captain. Now he's got a plan that he says is strictly business. He's being accused by his brother and some of the other made guys of making it personal, that there is spite in his calculations, which they think is a really bad idea. He's insisting that this is a completely business-oriented, dispassionate, rational decision that he's thought through. And I would argue that that bleeds out from the Cosa Nostra into general life, that if you do something, you have to at least try to justify it by saying it wasn't out of spite.
People often don't, I think, own their own spite when they are acting spitefully. I think you're onto something in terms of that. Even though, again, there's some research, and I think your guests later on are going to talk about this, that spite may actually serve an important social function in maintaining norms and having society work. Most people don't seem to want to acknowledge that they've acted spitefully. A nice thing about doing sort of online questionnaire research is I'm hoping we get sort of people willing to acknowledge and spiteful actions because it is anonymous and there's no way it can come back to them. But in everyday life, you don't see people too often saying, the reason I did this nasty thing was purely out of spite. They often will rationalize it and give some argument why, or at the very least, they'll argue that some social norm was violated, something unfair happened, and of course they had to respond that way.
We've got another clip for you about this, David Marcus. This is Jerry Seinfeld, who's bought a jacket and he's trying to return it. He's having a conversation with the salespeople about that.
Excuse me, I'd like to return this jacket.
Certainly. May I ask why?
First bite.
Spite?
That's right. I don't care for the salesman that sold it to me.
I don't think you can return an item for spite.
What do you mean?
Well, if there was some problem with the garment, if it were unsatisfactory in some way, then we could do it for you. But I'm afraid spite doesn't fit any of our conditions for a refund.
That's ridiculous. I want to return it. What's the difference what the reason is?
Let me speak with the manager. Excuse me. Bob?
What seems to be the problem?
Well, I want to return this jacket, and she asked me why, and I said for spite, and now she won't take it back.
That's true. We can't return an item based purely on spite.
Well, so fine, then. Then I don't want it. That's why I'm returning it.
Well, you already said spite, so...
I changed my mind.
No? You said spite. Too late.
So here we are at the level of the presentation of self in everyday life. And Jerry Seinfeld is talking to David Marcus more as if he's answering one of your questionnaires, right? In a questionnaire, he'd feel comfortable saying that I brought a jacket back one time because I just didn't like the people who sold it to me. But the comedy, the laughter in that bit is that we don't say these things.
Yeah, exactly. That was just a wonderful clip that I had no memory of from the show. That's fantastic. It's so people don't give that reason for why they do things all that often, except for maybe to people that they know very, very well. But in everyday life, you're right. We don't say that.
Now, all right. Well, David Marcus, it's been fantastic to talk to you, and we look forward to even more research. You're going to stay with Spite, I assume. I mean, you're raking across the surface here. I assume you're going to dig even deeper.
Yes, trying to. Next step is to look at how whether people's responses on a spitefulness scale predict how they'll behave in an ultimatum game. Will they be more spiteful in rejecting offers than folks who score as being less spiteful? That's one of the next things we're going to look at. But yeah, I've been interested in sort of these dark personality traits of spite and psychopathy and narcissism. And so, yeah, I'm going to stay in that area.
You sound like that. You've been the ideal guest today. I'm sure you'll be an ideal guest for us on future shows. We're interested in all of those things, too. So we promise to follow up with you. All right. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. And as David Marcus said, our next guest is going to talk about situations in which spite may actually be somewhat adaptive.
Dug up the hills to spite the sky. Tore out a stone to spite the lies. Cut down the trees to spite the shade. Laid her to rest to spite the life they made. Burned his Bible to spite the load. Took a day off to lick his wounds. I heard him swear, life is such a cursed affair. I'm gonna hold my breath. Stop breathing to spite the air.
All right, we're back. We're talking about spite. You know, in the world of sports, this has come up even in the last 24, 48 hours. University of Connecticut will be playing Notre Dame tonight. The coach of Notre Dame has kind of fractured the normal social compact that papers over the spite aspect. I mean, usually coaches have to sort of pretend that they just want a well-fought game. And Muffet McGraw is openly talking about the fact that UConn and Notre Dame hate each other. And, you know, that may be an example not only of hatred, but also of spite, because there are certain disadvantages that you incur once you admit that you bear true animosity against your opponent. So speaking of sports, I want to mention that tomorrow night, Wednesday night at 7 p.m., we'll be at Watkinson School for a program about sports. We call it How Do We Get Back to the Field of Dreams, talking a little bit about some of the innocence that's leached out of sports, both at the level of youth sports that our kids play all the way up to the very tippy-top, highest pinnacle of sports. We have a great panel for you. You're welcome to join us. You should contact Watkinson School right now, watkinson.org, for tickets. We'd love to see you there tomorrow night. We're going to have a pretty good crowd and a great panel and a great evening. So join us, 7 p.m., Watkinson School. All right, we're going to move on here. We're going to talk about spite as an adaptive behavior, or whether it can be an adaptive behavior. And to guide us through that, we have Rory Smead, an assistant professor of philosophy of biology at Northeastern University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Colin.
So, within your field, this gets talked about sometimes preceded by the word Hamiltonian, right? Hamiltonian altruism and Hamiltonian spite. So examples of this might be, the only one that I know, because it's the way I see the world, is the elephants sometimes defecate in watering holes that are going to be used. So they can't be used by rival packs of elephants. But there are examples of this in the animal world, right? Things that look like spite.
Yeah, there's actually numerous examples. And so there's a distinction between biological spite, what I'm going to be talking about, and what Professor Marcus is talking about, there's psychological spite. Psychological spite is usually defined in terms of motives or intentions, doing something with the motive or intention to harm someone, irrespective of gain, even at a cost. But biological spite is defined not in those psychological terms, but in terms of the fitness or reproductive success that comes about from the behavior. So spite, in the biological sense or the Hamiltonian sense, is behavior that inflicts a harm to another at a cost to the actor in sort of terms of reproductive success.
So give us, I guess, the yellow room.
Oh, sorry. The example. So there are several examples that we might bring up to illustrate this. One of the ones that I like is actually from Laurent Keller and Kenneth Ross in the 1998 paper in Nature about imported red fire ants that actively sort of seek out other ants that are slightly genetically different based on their scent and then kill them, even though they're part of the same ant hive. And there are other examples from spite in nature as well. The yellow-rumped cacique is a bird that the adolescent males will spend a good portion of their free time harassing nesting females, oftentimes resulting in fledgling's deaths with no apparent gains and the risk of harm by retaliating females.
Well, so that raises all kinds of huge question marks right away, right? I mean, behaviors that are part of a DNA code are supposed to be adaptive. They're supposed to have some kind of purpose. So you look at that and you wonder, well, what's the purpose? Is it possible to extrude a purpose from that kind of behavior?
Well, so it's interesting. This is precisely the reason that it's particularly fascinating to evolutionary theorists and biologists. Sort of by definition, spite is something that pays a cost. So why should we ever expect it to arise? It turns out that we have to think carefully about what we mean by costs and benefits here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that spite can do for us, even though by definition we have fewer children as a result of it, one of the things it can do is allow us to gain a relative advantage. It's a bit like taking a pay cut so that your colleagues have to take a bigger pay cut. Mm. In the biological sense, this would come out as, sure, I have fewer kids now, but you have even fewer than I do.
So that's one possible reason. As we get to sort of more advanced organisms, even primates and humans and stuff like that, do we see, is there a way in which spite introduces some kind of norm, some kind of enforceable behavior, some kind of understanding, well, if you do this, then this other thing will happen?
Yeah, so the interesting connection here is between spite and what I think most people might call punishment, right? Typically, if somebody is supposed to be acting in some way and they don't, they suffer some sort of consequences for that. And we typically think of it as punishment. And punishment is usually sort of characterized in a relatively what me and my co-author, Professor Forber, refer to as a pro-social behavior. But we like to think about the sort of potential dark side of punishment, that it might have closer links to spite rather than sort of making sure that we're all good to one another. Punishment may have been the outcome of something more like spite.
So, I mean, just to sort of be clear about that, in other words, what you're saying is, evolution looks at behaviors that can be either kind of random or at least not necessarily ascribable to any kind of beneficial purpose, but which kind of by accident do work that way. So that if in fact, some of our more limbic system responses to stuff make us engage in spiteful behavior when we're angry and we're almost irrationally angry, those could still get encoded as on a kind of evolutionary basis because they turn out to have a benefit that isn't even necessarily intended by the original actor.
Right, and that may have not been why it was selected for, to put it in those in sort of evolutionary terms. So our basic story is, or the sort of the basic picture that we think is a possibility. We don't know how much it corresponds to what actually happened, but as far as an evolutionary possibility goes, we think that there are certain conditions that favor spite, sort of straight up spite, in the ways that we've been talking about, just paying a cost to inflict a harm. And those conditions are where the behaviors are sort of disproportionately directed at those that are not like you or those that aren't doing the spite. Mm-hmm. And under those conditions, you can expect spite to gain that relative advantage that it needs to evolve. What that means is everybody does worse off because there's so much spite going on. But if you didn't spite, then you would do even worse, right? That's the idea.
Give me an example to kind of help. I'm having a little trouble wrapping my mind around that one.
With something like the imported red fire ants, one of the things that's going on is they detect pheromone scents, which are a genetic marker for what they're like. And they disproportionately reject their harming, attacking behavior at those that are different than them. Mm-hmm. And in those kind of conditions are exactly the kind of conditions that the sort of spite will give you a relative advantage by performing that. Although you have to pay a cost, the others that aren't like you are paying a bigger cost.
And, I don't mean to make this extrapolation, but it is kind of interesting to think about. One of the things I was thinking about today is religious and philosophical traditions that either do or don't have any component of spite. Most religious systems do incorporate some notion of punishment for wrongdoing. Even Jesus has his moments when he's railing against Pharisees and hypocrites and lawyers and scribes and telling them all the kind of bad things that are happening to them. And he curses a fig tree. So even he has moments like that. But you sort of – I find myself wondering today whether – you think of Tibetan Buddhism, which based on my study of it, isn't entirely, or my experience of it anyway, isn't entirely devoid of spite, but it doesn't have very much, you know? And then you have these the kind of predatory behavior of the Chinese government. You know, you can sort of look at that, and as I say, I don't want to have you say something that's academically unsound, but you do kind of wonder whether that's a real disadvantage, that they don't have the kind of spiteful component, that they don't lay that out very much as part of their social system.
Yeah, so there are some sort of potential benefits that can come from having spite present. So I'll talk about the ultimatum game for a second because
sure.
Professor Marcus brought it up, and that's actually one of the things that we studied in our recent paper that came out just a little while ago in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. So we presented an evolutionary model of the ultimatum game, which in a sense is just a mathematical description where we have little, in a sense, fictional reproducers playing the ultimatum game. And they're playing not for money, but they're playing for reproductive success. You might imagine, so the ultimatum game, just to restate it, is that there's two players. One player gets to propose a split, say 50-50 or 90-10, and the other player can either accept or reject it. And if they reject it, they get nothing. So the sort of economically rational strategy is the one that makes as large an offer as they can, assuming the other player is going to accept it, and they accept any offer that comes their way. A spiteful strategy would be one that does make a large offer, but also would reject any large offers that come their way, as sort of a hypocritical strategy even, and it's very harmful. What we did is we took a sort of an evolutionary model of the ultimatum game, and we cranked up the conditions that favor spite. This idea of what we call negative assortment, that is, strategies tend to interact with those that aren't like themselves. And when you crank up the conditions that favor spite, what you find is actually an increase in the proportion of fair offers that evolves, which is a little bit puzzling. But when you think about it in a little bit more detail, it starts making sense. What's going on is that as you increase spite, as you crank up the conditions that favor spite, the proportion of rejection starts increasing dramatically. But it turns out to be easier to spite the unfair players than it is to spite the fair players. Part of the nature of a fair offer is that if you reject it, you have to pay as big a cost to reject it as you would do as a harm to a harm for me. Whereas if I make you an unfair offer, say 90-10, you have to pay a cost of 10 to harm me 90, which is easier to get as far as the conditions that might favor spite. So fairness comes about because as a sort of defense mechanism against spite. So if you took fairness out, spite would still be there, but because spite is there and fairness is possible, we get fairness as well.
And I'm trying to sort of take that and transpose it to a situation of, let's say, limited numbers of resources. So you've got maybe rival groups who are going after different amounts of the same amounts of food, or trying to figure out how to divide up a territory that has, you know, a certain amount of berry bushes in it and stuff like that. So, well, give me your sense of how that model plays out there.
Yeah, the model is abstract. It doesn't have any obvious interpretation. But on the other hand, it does sort of kind of apply to a lot of different scenarios. One scenario that it does apply to is the sort of whether an animal arrives at a new area of land and has to decide how much of it to defend from others that might be using the land.
Right.
So that's sort of the demand, right? And the other can either challenge or not challenge, right? Or sort of accept the portion of the land that the other organism gives him. But it might come up in other areas. So, for instance, the amount of time that parents spend, or the amount of resources or time that parents spend investing in their children. Both parents want their children to do well, but they're sort of at odds with respect to they'd both prefer the other one to sort of do the lion's share of the work in biological context, feeding, defense, things like that.
That's going to come up as a conversation in some households that listen to this show, I think. This is a fascinating stuff. We're going to sort of move from here to the area of pure political behavior where there seems to be an awful lot of spite. So thank you so much, Rory Smead. Rory Smead is a professor of philosophy of biology at Northeastern University. Let's grab a quick break here. We'll come back. We'll talk about it in the world of politics. Just for spite. Just for spite. Just for spite.
Yeah.
The lesson is clear. People who are ruled by spite and envy and vengefulness are jerks and should die and burn like pigs in hell, and I should get their cars if they have nice ones. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are spiteful Greg, George, Anthony, Andrew Shabazz Lishke, and jealous Jane Ashley. Greg Hill appeared in our intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Fredo Corleone. For show pages, articles, and PDFs of the anonymous hate mail the Faith Middleton Show staff has written to Giada De Laurentiis, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, Thomas More and Colin talk about having a religion of one's own. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Thomas More. We've had one full-length, full-show conversation before. He's going to be back in town, actually, this afternoon. We'll be having another conversation, which you will hear tomorrow as we get ready for our event at Watkinson School. So we're going to move on, and this is an area where I might expect to get a few phone calls also as we go along, because I think it's something a lot of people are observing, this notion that spite as good a word as any, anyway, that spite has pervaded the American political process, both at the level of the big players, the people actually in Congress, the people in the executive branch, and also maybe at the level of the voters. And we're going to talk about both of those with Alan Abramowitz. He is the Alban W. Barkley Professor of Political Science at Emory University. So, Alan Abramowitz, first of all, we know that spite is not a new thing in politics, and people who watch the movie Lincoln, you know, watching the coarseness of the debate and Tommy Lee Jones calling people addlepated nincompoops, and you know, we know that, you know, the people have taken a cane to one another on the floor of the Senate in previous times. Spite isn't new in politics. So if there's a difference now, what's that difference?
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. It's not a new thing in politics, but it's certainly true, I think, that in recent years we're seeing an uptick in the level of personal animosity that we're seeing in politics, name-calling, just generally negative feelings about the other side. And I think we're seeing this not only among leaders in Congress, for example, but even within the public, or at least, you know, within that segment of the public who are engaged in politics, who care about politics. Yes, I mean, I think, you know, what's really underlying this is, first of all, a growing divide between the parties, a growing divide on issues, but also a growing divide in terms of, you know, the kinds of people who support the two parties in terms of their social characteristics.
Yeah. Now, I want to talk about this at both of these levels, but we can start at the level of leadership. And I'm not a political scientist, but it strikes me that what's happened is, although there are ideological divides, and it's maybe possible to measure which ones have been more extreme over history, the difference kind of goes back to what our first guest said about the nature of spite, which is that you can call it spite when it begins to interfere with other desirable outcomes. One thing I discovered just the other day is that a member there, I was talking about a specific member of Congress who's been in there for, I'd say, about four terms in the House of Representatives, so maybe 8 years, maybe 10 years, something like that. He's never been on a conference committee, ever, not once, because conference committees, which are used to resolve disputes between chambers and arrive at an outcome. I mean, the whole idea is we need to get a bill done. We need to make a law. We have to have conference committees in order to get that done. They don't happen as much anymore. They're very rare things.
Right.
And it seems as though the outcome is less important than the animosity that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I also think that it's harder to reconcile differences between bills passed by the House and Senate when you have chambers controlled by different parties, and again, when the differences between the chambers on these issues are often very, very large. So it's a combination of sort of partisanship, ideological differences, and then just the fact that neither side really trusts the other side, and there's a tendency to view those on the other side with suspicion and as being not just people we disagree with on issues, but in many cases, these are people who are just bad people who have bad motives, and therefore you shouldn't negotiate with them. And if you're seen as cooperating with the other side, actually that can be held against you.
We're talking to Alan Abramowitz. His books include The Disappearing Center and The Polarized Public, two very apt choices for what we're talking about now. Well, I want to come back to leadership, but let's go look down at the grassroots level here. So one thing that gets examined sometimes is, you know, Thomas Frank wrote, you know, What's the Matter with Kansas? So, and his argument there is, well, it seems like voters – are not voting in their best interest at times, you know, that in fact they're voting in the interest of people who are not them. You know, why would they do this? One possible explanation is that they're not so much, it's not so much that they're not voting in their best interest, but they are voting out of spite. They're voting against the interests of other people, which whom they can sort of vaguely imagine, whom they don't want to help out.
Yeah, I think there's some truth to that. We tend to see those on the other side, and I'm talking about among the within the public now, you know, as being you know, different from us, and as having bad motives. And so, you know, in the case of you know, those on the left, I think to often view voters on the right as conservatives as either, you know, being just, you know, rich people who want to just game the system to advance their economic interests, or as, you know, super religious people who want to impose their will, you know, on everyone else. And on the right, there's a tendency to view those, you know, voters on the left as being, you know, just out to get things for free, and being lazy and you know, not wanting to work and wanting to just you know, live off of welfare.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big questions is if it's true, which I would say it is, that and the average person is more likely to lose his or her health insurance than to suddenly acquire $2 or $3 million more dollars than that person has.
Right.
Why does that person vote against expansions in access to health insurance and in favor of tax structures that favor people who are much wealthier than said, you know, example person is?
Yeah.
And I do think sometimes they are voting against, they're not voting for something, they're voting a bunch against a whole bunch of people that they don't want to have take advantage of some new benefit that's provided.
Yeah, I think that that's true to some extent, and I also think that certainly one of the factors underlying that is race.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what you're seeing is that there's a lot of suspicion among conservatives that, you know, the people who are benefiting from these government programs, including the Affordable Care Act, you know, are not only, you know, they're lazy and they're not willing to work hard, and, you know, they follow this sort of, you know, supposedly traditional American path to get ahead. But they're also sort of different people, and they're not like us. And race certainly has a lot to do with that. And I think that that plays into views of not only of some of these issues, but views of President Obama and views of, you know, the types of people who voted for the president.
Yeah, I think race, but also class and education enter into this. I'll give you an example, too. In 1993, President Clinton was starting his first term, and his first nominee for attorney general was a woman named Zoe Beard. And
right.
It was eventually found that she, you know, had a very high-paying job, really, with an insurance company here in Connecticut, and she'd maybe employed illegal immigrants as nannies or whatever. And I was actually a talk show host on a commercial station at the time, and I got calls on this every day, all day long. And after a while, I started to realize that it wasn't so much about the facts of the case, because the facts of the case, although they were somewhat damning, weren't as damning as all kinds of other things that were going on at the same moment. It was basically this really kind of die, yuppie scum, you know, that was sort of what underlay the dialogue. It was kind of like, I don't like you. You've got all these advantages. You know, you're the kind of person who's been bossing me around my entire life, telling me I can't smoke. I hate you.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely something to that. And of course, the ironic thing is, I mean, that sort of behavior goes on, you know, on both sides of the partisan aisle. I mean, that's not really something that differentiates
yes.
Democrats from Republicans.
Oh, absolutely. I would agree with that. And to a certain degree, the consultants have tried to figure this out, too, whether it's George Lakoff on the left or Frank Luntz on the right, Drew Weston looking at sort of how the political brain works. One of the things is to try to understand this really fundamental limbic response that people have to certain words, to certain emotional tripwire
right.
issues, right?
Yeah, and I think there's a tendency also to see the president and liberals as being somehow un-American. Mm-hmm. And part of that, I think, is it gets based on race, but I mean, part of it also reflects this sort of cultural divide that you have in American politics now, where the country is really divided in terms of people's religious beliefs, that's something that's relatively new. I mean, we didn't see that. If you go back, 30 or 40 years, we weren't really divided. There was a division between a traditional divide between Protestants and Catholics, but it didn't have to do with your religious beliefs or how religious you were. But now there really is this divide, and we see it on issues like gay rights, on abortion, and so on. So, and those are very emotional issues, and ones that it's hard to compromise on those issues, at least for the people who really care about those issues.
It does seem as though, once again, at the level of kind of our normative understanding, that Americans will, to a certain degree, tolerate behavior, at least on their own side, whatever their own side of the political divide is, of spiteful behavior that's directed at or guided by some kind of ideology, or at least
right.
appears to be. You know, the thing that they won't tolerate, or I think they're less likely to tolerate, is spite for spite's sake. So we're watching that unfold right now with so-called Bridgegate. I mean, if in fact it's the case that Chris Christie closed a bridge out of sheer spite, or that somebody working for Chris Christie closed access lanes to a bridge out of pure spite, and Republicans and Democrats were stuck in the same traffic jam anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me that that's going to be processed in a different way.
Well, it's kind of interesting on that, though. If you look at what's happened to public opinion, since those revelations, actually Christie's popularity among Republicans hasn't been damaged. In fact, he's getting perhaps more support from Republicans than he was before. He was viewed with some suspicion, I think, by conservative Republicans before as being someone, who was too moderate, too willing to compromise, to work with Democrats. But now that he's being attacked by Democrats, you're seeing some evidence of a conservative rallying behind him. So I'm not quite sure if that's true. I mean, I think that kind of spiteful behavior may not be hurting him very much on his own side of the aisle. His problem is that he's the governor of a very Democratic state, you can't survive that kind of thing and continue to be have a high approval rating in a state like New Jersey.
Last question, because we're running out of time, not because this isn't fascinating, because it absolutely is fascinating. But you sort of wonder also about the change in the media climate, right? You have more ideological mm-hmm. and partisan-directed media. So whether it's Ed Schultz on the left or, Glenn Beck on the right, it's sort of okay to be in attack mode now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so, again, I think that the message that you get from a lot of these the partisan media, whether it's some of the cable TV channels or talk radio or blogs, is that, again, it's that the not just the leaders, but the supporters, the voters on the other side are bad people and have bad motives, and so therefore it's okay if bad things happen to them. Because they're trying to take advantage of you, and they would hurt you if they had the opportunity. So it's okay to hurt them.
Your books include The Disappearing Center and The Polarized Public. Is there an end in sight to all this?
I don't think there's an end in sight anytime soon. In fact, I actually think it's going to get worse. I think in the aftermath of the upcoming elections, you're going to see, for example, a more polarized Senate than we have now, regardless of which party is in control. So, I'm afraid not, at least not for the next couple of election cycles.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, that was a non-uplifting note to end on, but it's going to have to. That's all right. It's going to have to do. Alan Abramowitz, thank you so much for joining us. I want to thank Betsy Kaplan and Kyan Wolf for producing today's show. And remind you, feel free to join us tomorrow night at Watkinson School. It would be good if you got in touch with Watkinson School beforehand, either on their phone line or at Watkinson.org, for our 7 p.m. summit on the future of sports, on how we lost some of the innocence of sports, whether we can get it back. We'll all be enjoying a women's basketball game tonight. Many of us will be anyway. But on Wednesday morning, we may have a whole bunch of other questions to ask. So anyway, Thomas Moore will be on the show tomorrow. And then tomorrow night, we're at Watkinson School. We'd love to have you join us. Thanks to everybody who listened today. And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Is it love or spite that drives you to his arms? Can you make your heart believe it's right? that you are doing wrong. Tell me, darling, is it love or is it spite?
I'm Kyone Wolf, and I don't try to improve my work here because I have naysayers. I do it in spite of them.
Kyone, you don't really have any naysayers.
Oh, I better find some or else I'm going to get really bad at this job.